Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, November 30th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
This is our chance. This is our chance to deliver relief for the people who've sent us here.
Will you get this done by Christmas, Senator?
I hope so.
There is growing momentum for this, and I am confident that we're going to get this done soon, get it to the president's desk, and the president is eagerly looking forward to signing it.
The eyes of the world now turn to the United States Senate.
Well, maybe overstating it a bit, but the eyes of anyone who pays taxes or who runs a corporation that wants a big tax cut should be on the Senate, because the Senate's $1.5 trillion tax overhaul is now on the floor and looks ready to pass by the end of the week.
We do have a few members who have concerns, and we're trying to address them. And we know we would not be able to go forward until we get 50 people satisfied, and that's what we're working on.
The president made a case yesterday for a bill that, if he gets it, would be the only significant legislative accomplishment in a unified Republican government in the first year of his presidency. The president was in St. Louis yesterday.
We cannot sit idly by and watch ourselves losing in competition to other countries as they continue to take away our jobs because their tax codes are more competitive and less burdensome than ours.
This is a major selling point for this Republican tax bill. The vast majority of the tax benefit is targeted at U.S. corporations. For individuals, it's the wealthiest who get the most benefit. Here's the president.
If we do this, then America will win again like never, ever before. The eyes of the world.
Well, we have some more information now on just who will be doing the winning. The Joint Committee on Taxation in Congress put out a report last night. JCT says 60% of American households will see a tax cut in 2019 under this bill. But for most, it's tiny. Two-thirds of that group get a tax cut of less than $100, and the rest, no tax cut at all, or even an increase. Ben Castleman is here with me now. Ben is economic, business, and data reporter for the New York Times. And Ben ran the numbers on 25,000 middle-class American families. Ben, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what's that you've got there? Is that a 1040 form?
I brought a 1040 form just in case. We can be prepared here.
Maybe you and I can fill it out together.
We can work on it together.
Well, I don't want to do that while management is watching, although maybe I should. Thanks for bringing that, because that 1040 form is what American families use to file their taxes. It's going to be important. Ben, 25,000 families is a pretty big sample size. When it comes to middle-class families and how they're likely to fare under this Senate bill, what's the bottom line of what you found?
Yeah, and we actually ran this on about 500,000 families and then just showed you 25,000
at the New York Times.
So look, the big picture here is most families, about two-thirds of middle-class families, would get a tax cut in the first years of this bill. And that "in the first years" thing is important, and we can talk about that in a moment. But most families would benefit. That would, as you noted, be generally small, but in some cases be pretty significant. But there's a huge diversity here. And, you know, when we've heard talk about this bill, we hear a lot about averages, or you hear about typical families that would win or that would lose that are kind of brought out by proponents and opponents of the plan. But the reality is there's tremendous diversity in American households. The tax code is very complex. And so two families that could look pretty similar on paper, earn about the same amount of money, could win or lose in hugely different ways under this plan.
Okay, a little bit of housekeeping. What's middle class in your analysis?
So we define middle class as anyone earning two-thirds to double the median income, but we adjusted that for the size of the household. So if you're a couple, that kind of puts you in the, you know, earning $30,000 to $90,000. If you're a family of four, you know, that ends up being kind of $40,000 up to $125,000, right? Because it costs a lot more to live with a larger family.
And so you mentioned that American households are very, very diverse. There's lots of different factors that shape how much they pay. What are the most important features of an American family that determine whether they win, lose, or are sort of flush under this tax plan.
Yeah, so the single biggest thing is whether you currently take the standard deduction or you itemize, right? So we hear a lot about all these various tax deductions, the mortgage interest deduction, state and local taxes, right? The majority of Americans actually don't have to worry about any of that. They take this lump sum standard deduction. And under the GOP bill, under pretty much either version of this bill, they would more or less double, close to double that, which means that if you take that standard deduction now, you end up with less taxable income, and so you pay less in taxes. If you itemize your deductions, which is, tends to be somewhat wealthier people, but also includes a lot of middle-class taxpayers, especially in higher income and higher tax states, then it's about a coin flip whether you would get a tax cut or a tax increase mm-hmm. in this bill in those first years.
Well, Ben, we put out the call to Takeaway listeners who have lots and lots of questions about their own taxes, their own income, and how they're going to do under this Senate bill. Now, we should add the Senate is probably going to negotiate with the House. Some things could change. So this is subject to politics and negotiation among lawmakers. But we know a lot now. Let me read you from a listener in Missouri. We got this note. I'm a single PhD student in St. Louis making $25,000 a year with $48,000 in tuition waivers. I do not itemize. So what about that listener?
Yeah, and so I should caveat this also. I am not a tax accountant or an accountant of any kind.
Right.
And we, of course, don't have all the details on these people's finances. But this listener is a really interesting case. Under the Senate bill, this person would almost certainly see a modest tax cut, a few hundred dollars in 2018. They take the standard deduction. That standard deduction is doubled, lower taxable income. The House bill is a very different story because this is a graduate student. Most PhD students in this country, they don't actually have to pay the tuition that they're theoretically charged. Under the House bill, they would call that tuition income. Waived tuition would be income. And so her tax bills would probably go way up under the House plan.
All right, let's hear now from a mom with kids, maybe a typical American.
Hi, this is Karen from Forum Park, New Jersey, and I am definitely concerned about the tax bill affecting me. My marital status is divorced. I claim head of household and one child as a dependent. My household income is $44,000, and I do take standard deduction for that child.
So there's Karen in New Jersey, divorced, one child, $44,000 in income, and takes the standard deduction. What does the Senate bill mean for Karen?
Yeah, so it's a little bit tricky here. She would, based on kind of what we understand about what she told us, would probably also get a tax cut of a few hundred dollars. She'd benefit from that standard deduction, but also the Senate bill would double the child tax credit, which means that right now she gets a $1,000 tax credit for that child. Under the Senate bill, it would be $2,000. That helps her. But it's worth noting, New Jersey is a very high tax state, and it's especially a high property tax state. It sounds like Karen probably doesn't own her own home, or if she does, it's probably a pretty modest home. But I'm betting a lot of her neighbors do itemize their deductions, and they would probably lose out under that bill.
And she might be different than her neighbors there. Okay, here's a Takeaway listener. I think we're going to Texas now, to Austin. Listeners who are dealing with debt.
We are a young couple living in Austin, Texas, married. We have an 8-month-old daughter. The one working member of our family is a self-employed freelance editor, slated to make about $80,000 before taxes this year. We itemize deductions, and to make it interesting, we also are paying on at least $80,000 in student loans, and we have between $15,000 and $20,000 in medical debt.
Okay, Ben, $80,000 in income, but also a lot of student debt, some medical debt, and self-employed.
Yeah, and this is, you thought it was complicated before, right?
Yeah.
This is where it really gets a little bit complicated. So that student debt under the House bill would be a big problem for them because they'd no longer be able to write off some of that, at least under the original version of the House bill. The Senate bill, that wouldn't be a problem. However, they itemized their deductions. I sort of had to make some assumptions about how much they might write off, but they would probably pay a little bit more in the early years under the Senate bill, but with an important caveat, which is that The caller said that they are self-employed or it's freelance income. Depending on how they structure things, they may set that up as a small business, as a so-called pass-through entity, and as a result could get a big tax cut under the bill. So the details of their finances, and this really sort of speaks to this point about how complicated all of this is, two families with exactly the same income, if they earn it slightly differently, could either get a tax cut or a tax increase.
Depending on how they structure
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And yeah, that could be the difference between getting some in your pocket or giving some
or losing
up
out, right.
Under this plan. All right, let's go to Utah. And this is a listener, I think, who probably falls outside of your definition of middle class.
Hi, I live in Utah. Our total family income is about $340,000 annually. I'm married with three children. We did itemize our deductions last year. Looking back, it was about $50,000 in deductions. $17,000 of that was for state income taxes paid, and I think $12,000 was for mortgage deduction. The rest was charitable giving. And I think we owed about $5,000 due to the alternative minimum tax.
So $340,000, this listener in Utah is doing pretty well compared to a lot of the people that you analyzed in the New York Times analysis. How's he going to do?
Yeah, by pretty much any definition, $340,000 lies outside
right.
the middle class. So this family would probably do very, very well under this bill. They right now pay the alternative minimum tax, which is meant to make sure that kind of higher earning families don't get away with paying too little. Under this bill, they'd get rid of the AMT. They have three children. They'd get a big cut because of the doubled child tax credit and some other sort of details about the way they changed the tax credit. It's worth also highlighting, they're in Utah, make a lot of charitable contributions. Charitable contributions, that deduction sticks around under this bill. A lot of other deductions, including the state and local income tax, which they also benefit from, would go away.
The charitable deduction is reduced in the House bill, though, quite a bit, isn't it?
The charitable deduction, I believe, stays the same in both bills.
Okay. Well, Ben, I want to ask you about the out years, though. We've talked a lot about how people might do next year or 2019 or 2020. What is Congress saying, though, about how you might fare 7, 8, 9 years down the road? The accountants around Congress think about that stuff. The budgeteers do. Ordinary people don't often get a chance to.
Yeah, so the Senate bill, for example, the way it's written, pretty much all of these benefits that we've just been talking about, the doubled standard deduction, the higher child tax credit, pretty much all of that goes away after 2025. Now, the reason for that is that the authors of the bill had to keep the cost down for some sort of procedural reasons to try to get it through. But if you just take the bill as written, almost everybody would see either a tax increase or no change in the last years of this bill under the individual provisions. The corporate tax cuts would be permanent. Mm. The individual cuts would disappear.
So Congress will have to come back to save the little guy. The corporations have their tax cuts permanent. Ben, I'm going to let you go, but before I do, there are still a lot of negotiations to go between House and Senate, most likely. One or two things you want regular Takeaway listeners to watch out for when they're looking for the final product.
First of all, recognize that this is complex and it's going to affect different households differently. And then look what happens on the corporate tax rate. There's been some talk about bumping it up just a little bit, which would free up a lot of money to help middle-class earners.
And there might be more available then for regular earners to have their tax cut if corporations can give up just a little bit.
That's exactly right.
Ben Castleman with the New York Times. By the way, check out Ben's analysis in the New York Times. You'll see a spray chart of dots, red and blue, that will teach you a lot about how you might fare under the Senate bill. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, this week and next, we're looking at the state and the future of the political parties in America. It's Republicans next week. And Republicans, don't forget, we want to hear from you on what you want from your party at 8778-MY-TAKE. But let's now go back to 2015, when Democrats were feeling pretty good. I give you Minnesota Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison on ABC with George Stephanopoulos.
All I want to say is that anybody from the Democratic side of the fence who's terrified of the possibility of President Trump better vote, better get active, better get involved, because this man has got some momentum, and we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket.
Next, I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on to Matthew Dowd.
Sorry to laugh.
Sorry to laugh, says New York Times Maggie Haberman, you hear there. Now, Ellison was sounding the alarm bells for his party, and it's clear now that not enough Democrats were listening. But one election and a vicious Clinton-Sanders primary later, Keith Ellison is now deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee. Progressives under the Bernie banner are fighting it out with establishment Dems inside the DNC right now. And Ellison is one of the standard bearers. He says the way to heal the wounds and appeal to voters is with big economic messages and not just targeted advertisements.
My prediction now is that if we get to the doors and engage Americans in a really substantive way, that we will be able to comprise a set of policy prescriptions that will help working and middle and low-income Americans, and that will directly translate into election success as long as we are faithful to what we learn on the doors. We will win big.
Well, I want to talk about how you and the Democratic Party are going to do that, Congressman, because a great weakness of your opponent right now are two things, it seems. One, President Trump is relatively politically weak, but the Republican Party is also sharply divided. But you're divided as well, Democrats. Is it the party of Hillary? Is it the party of Bernie? And these divisions are real.
Well, we don't need absolute unanimity on everything. What we need is a basic recognition that this economy isn't working for working people. My position is very simple. We haven't seen this much income and wealth inequality since the Gilded Age. We got to be the party that fights for retirement security. I think we should fight for Medicare for all. I think we should fight for not just a $15 minimum wage, but really strong overtime and the right to organize in a union. And we need to fight for climate change and really build a renewable economy. People believe that, you know, the banks are taking advantage of them, you know, with the whole Wells Fargo scandal. People are sick of that, man. They are ready for a new kind of message. And what I'm saying is that the Democratic Party has gotten too into the TV, the targeting, the data analytics. It needs to get just back to listening to constituents. And if we do that, we'll win. I'm just going to say, you know, the last time it really felt like people were into what we were doing is when John Lewis led us to the House floor after the horrific Pulse nightclub shooting. And House Democrats went to the floor and took over the well of the House. I mean, people were really, really excited. And you know why they were excited? Because we were fighting back. They could see us fighting back. It was palpable to them. What they want to see us doing is putting forth a Herculean effort on their behalf, right? They want us to stand up to the big banks, stand up to the monopolies. They want us to stand up and be found fighting on their behalf. You are right. The Democratic Party is having its own contest of ideas. I think the debate is good, and I think it ought to be more public. And I tell you why. The people who think that we can win elections on just data analytics and micro-targeting and TV, they're wrong. They should present their views. And I want to present mine, and we'll see who wins. The people who think we don't need to be fighting for Medicare for all, let's have that debate. I would love that debate. We need more debate. If you don't think Medicare for all is right, you stand up and you publicly say you're against it. And I will publicly say why it's the right policy. And then the Democrats across this country will make a choice as to who they want to support.
Well, Congressman, that debate is going to happen because Senator Bernie Sanders, as you know, reintroduced his single-payer Medicare for All health care bill. And look who rushed to sign on. A lot of senators who people view as potential Democratic primary hopefuls, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris. Single-payer is probably going to be a litmus test for the Democratic presidential primary in 2020. It seems like you're going to get your wish.
Well, it'll be a litmus test before that because there's about 120 House members who are on it, including me, original co-sponsor. We're going to, in 2018, you know, Americans around this country are going to want to know, are you here to just give me more corporate health care to make insurance companies richer and richer? Or are you on my side, us in this neighborhood? That's the real issue. As much as I am 100% for the Affordable Care Act, I still believe that there are people who are not insured. There's still people who might face bankruptcy because they got sick. We got to solve this. And I think we've got to do it as a nation. It is time.
Congressman, as you know, that argument has a lot of resonance with lots and lots of Democrats, lots of progressives. Hillary Clinton's position and the position of many, many people around her was that in a general election, a progressive, liberal, maybe socialist policy like that can't win, too easy to vilify, stick with the Affordable Care Act, that this litmus test that you're talking about won't win a general election, and the future of the party has to win the big races.
Well, I'm grateful for the Affordable Care Act. I'm honored that I voted for it. But I tell you this, it would be better if we had a public option in it. Americans are ready to take the next step, in my opinion. Whenever I go talk about this in my district, it's wildly popular. People believe in it, right? Even in Minnesota, where we have one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country, even before the Affordable Care Act, people are ready to step up and move forward on this.
So, Congressman, let's talk about how the party has this debate and other ones like it. Because as I mentioned, Bernie Sanders reintroduced this bill. He's done it year after year. That's not new. What does it mean for the future of the party to have Bernie Sanders continuing to have such a heavy influence, such a heavy pull on the Democratic Party from the outside of the party?
I think it's a great thing. But I mean, I challenge this idea that Bernie is outside of the party. He's technically an independent. But he has helped lead Democratic Senators Outreach Program. He has been trusted with that position by Chuck Schumer. And, you know, he supports Democratic politicians all the time, including me and many others. So this idea that he's somehow not one of us, I think is a very short-sighted perspective to take.
Do you think it's critical in future primaries that the Democrats avoid the kind of fight they had over delegates and superdelegates and the type of primary that you had in 2016?
I think we should set up rules that encourage people to be involved. I don't think the Democratic Party should ever appear like an exclusive club that you have to have long-term involvement with in order to participate. Now, I know that for some people, they would fear that, you know, Republicans might, you know, come in and somehow muck up the primary outcomes. I think that if anyone could prove to me that that has ever really happened, I'd love to have the conversation. And I think that ought to be part of the debate. And if it's a real thing, then we should figure out how to deal with that. But if there is a bias in the rules, it should favor openness.
Well, Congressman, I want to talk a little bit more about party polarization. Your party is moving to the left, and you talked about the importance of a real progressive economic household message for Democrats in the future. How can you keep the Joe Manchins of the world winning in West Virginia, or the Heidi Heitkamps of the world winning in North Dakota, pretty conservative places where Democrats do not do well, while pursuing the progressive agenda that you seem to be advocating?
By getting involved with people on the ground, at the doors, in the VFW halls, in the union halls, in the church basements. I mean, I think it's important to note that in 2014, the last midterm, voter turnout was only 36%. There's a lot of places where turnout is very low. And so I think what Democrats need to do is really get back involved in a massive way with the American people. And that means not just television ads, not just mailers, not just polls, but really make the party a palpable reality in the lives of people. What I mean is a lot of canvassing, a lot of community meetings. The Democratic Party should be there to try to help people through their toughest times. We should be there when the floods happen and the fires happen and the hurricanes happen. We should be there to help feed the homeless. We should be there to help seniors. But we need to really engage volunteers on a massive new level so that, one, we're hearing from folks, so we don't have to guess what they want. We don't need a poll because we already know. We were at the meeting. Secondly, you know, we need a party that is willing to fight. You know, I'm going to tell you, people stop me and say, what's the Democratic Party message? Well, I'm like, you know who came up with Social Security? Yeah, the Democrats. You know who passed the 1965 Voting Rights Act? Oh, yeah, that's the Democrats. And you know who passed the Affordable Care Act? Oh, that's Democrats too. Yeah, so what do you mean, what's our message? What's our message? What are we willing to pick a fight over? You know, and that is what message really is. You know, it's relationship. It is policy. But it also is follow through. It is the idea that we're willing to throw down for what we believe in. You know, you asked an important question about some folks who are considered politically conservative on social issues. At the end of the day, if we talk strong economics, we solve a lot of social issues. Why? Because so many people who are from historically marginalized groups suffer that marginalization economically. Talk about low-income African-American moms who may have faced massive incarceration in some of the communities they represent. Well, have you thought about what prison phone rates are just to call your loved one who's incarcerated? Or has anybody really delved into the economics of being trans? Just trying to get a job, trying to get rent. I mean, if you want to know who really got socked hard in the 2008 financial crisis, ask a former black homeowner. They got punched harder than anyone. I mean, these issues are key. So it's not really true that these issues are separated, because so many people who come from historically marginalized groups suffer that marginalization economically.
Congressman, talk to me about how you think about the future of politics in this country. I mean, you talk about a progressive economic message for Democrats, of course. Republicans, as you know, have a large part of their party identity in really vilifying Democrats and liberals and anyone who's not in the conservative fold. Is there any cooperation on any of these issues in our future? You seem to really be talking about the places where progressives and Democrats can get the fight on, not in finding ways to really get them done in government. That doesn't really seem possible.
Well, I don't agree. I think that what I'm talking about, there's a lot of broad agreement on across the American spectrum. In my opinion, the Republican voting base and the Republicans in office have a great schism between them. And if you doubt that, just look at the Trump election. Guess what? Republicans like Social Security. Republicans believe in public investment in infrastructure. And Republicans believe that we need to have a fair trade model and a model that lifts up labor standards around the world, not creates more of a race to the bottom. So look, man, I think that regular Democrats and regular Republicans agree on much more than, you know, we give them credit for. I think the problem is what has happened in our country is that since Reagan, really, we cut taxes for the richest people and we pushed deregulation. That has allowed wealthy corporations and individuals to amass vast sums of money, which they then use to buy political influence. And that has created a situation where people feel dramatically alienated and they don't feel their government's responsive to them. And so the answer is clearly re-engagement on a massive scale, where we're really having Democratic activists on the doorstep of Americans all over this country, and we are fighting for a program that's going to make their lives better.
Congressman Keith Ellison, I'm going to let you go. I can't let you go, as you know, without the prediction. How many House seats are you going to take back 2018?
At least 24.
Enough to win it? Majority?
Yeah.
That's Congressman Keith Ellison of Minneapolis, Minnesota, deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee. Part of his job is to predict a Democratic takeover of the House in 2018. We'll see if he and the Democrats get there. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Early Wednesday morning, President Trump retweeted three videos from a Twitter account linked to an ultra-nationalist group in the UK called Britain First. The group's been condemned as an extremist organization that targets mosques and Muslims.
Jihad and Islam are one and the same. It's not a separate entity. Every single Muslim is obliged to kill you and your husbands and your wives and your children. Are we getting this yet?
You're hearing there Jada Franzen. She's deputy leader of Britain First. That was a speech on her Twitter feed. Now, the videos that the president of the United States tweeted were especially inflammatory and in some cases of questionable authenticity. One video claimed to show a Muslim immigrant beating up a white Dutch teen on crutches. Turns out both the teens were born in the Netherlands, and authorities won't comment on their religions. The president's promotion of Britain First drew swift reactions in the UK. Prime Minister Theresa May condemned the tweets. The Archbishop of Canterbury issued what he said was an urgent call for the president to delete them. Here is the response from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
The threat is real, and that's what the president is talking about, is the need for national security, the need for military spending, and those are very real things. There's nothing fake about that.
Well, President Trump has tweeted inflammatory, racist, and false information for years. But since he began his campaign for the presidency, there's been another person behind the message at Real Donald Trump, and that's his director of social media, Dan Scavino. Ashley Feinberg is a senior reporter at HuffPost. She's here, and Ashley's done plenty of reporting on Dan Scavino and the president's statements on Twitter. Ashley, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Ashley, who is Dan Scavino, and how did he get into the campaign and into the White House?
Well, Dan Scavino has actually been with Trump the longest of most of the people in his inner circle right now. He started working for him when he was in high school, actually. He was 16. He was a caddy. Trump said he was going to offer him a job one day and eventually had him head up his Westchester golf club. And then as Trump started running for president, Dan Scavino got on board and has just sort of been there the whole time.
What does he do now?
He does what he does in the campaign, which is just running every social media account that Trump has, making videos for it, photos, tweeting when Trump during the workday, essentially everything.
When we see a real Donald Trump tweet, is there a way to know how often that's the president picking up his phone and writing out a tweet and how often it's Dan Scavino writing in the president's voice?
It's not easy to tell because Dan Scavino has essentially been able to mimic Trump exactly, but the time of day is usually a good indicator, mostly because in the morning, Dan's not at work yet, and Trump is sitting on his couch watching Fox News, tweeting himself. So that those are usually him, but it's before 10 a.m. or so. And then late at night, too, like the 10:30 tweets are usually Trump. But during the day, it's more up for grabs.
And so there have been a lot of examples of controversial, sometimes anti-Semitic, often racist tweets from the president where people have wondered where the information he's retweeting. There was an example in the campaign of a tweet that involved a Star of David, a Jewish star that Trump and his team later tried to pass off as a sheriff's star. And then there were the tweets this week retweeting a right-wing nationalist anti-Muslim group in the UK. Is the president finding this content himself, or do people basically think that that comes from Dan Scavino's research?
Well, so with the sheriff star instance, that was definitely Dan. They said it was Dan. And then also there's the factor that Trump's phone only has a Twitter app, essentially, so he can't really browse the web in the same sense that, like, Dan can go on Reddit and start looking through all these photos and videos that he adds to tweets. But with the retweet specifically, Ann Coulter had retweeted those videos the night before, and so it would make sense if Trump was scrolling through in the morning and saw them and saw some videos he liked and just thought it would be fun to retweet them. That was probably him. But anytime there's like a video attached to one of Trump's own tweets, a picture attached, that's always going to be Dan.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Reddit, social media platform online. Where is Dan Scavino getting his material? What does he do online that sort of funnels into the presidential message here?
So Dan Scavino's big role right now is sort of checking in on the base and seeing what they're tweeting, what memes they're tweeting out. He's the one who sort of goes through the muck and finds these terrible images and these videos of CNN getting beat up in WrestleMania that are getting tweeted out. Like that, those are coming from Dan. They're coming from Reddit. They're coming from these MAGA Twitter accounts he follows. It's all there.
So Dan Scavino spends time online with the Trump base on places like Reddit, 4chan, right, other social media platforms, finds stuff that he likes that's grassroots and elevates it?
Yeah, essentially. He usually does not credit it, but he will just pass it off as they'll say that he just found this meme online or he just found it going through Trump's base, but it's usually almost always from the Donald Trump subreddit.
So what about the transformation from things online that Dan Scavino likes to the presidential message of the president of the United States? I mean, apparently other White House aides have pleaded with Dan Scavino to tone down his tweets, have pleaded with the president to do it, but Dan Scavino's not the president, have asked him to not elevate this kind of stuff to the presidential level. It seems to have had no effect.
Everyone in the White House seems to want Trump to tweet less, except for Dan Scavino. He has always been very adamant that he wants Donald Trump to be Donald Trump, and he's not creating the message. He is the messenger in his eyes of this sort of angry, vitriolic message that Trump wants to get out. And Dan sees Trump and his base as completely intertwined.
So, Ashley, there are real-world consequences here other than people getting mad at the president's tweets. Over the last couple of days, the Libyan government began denying CNN's recently compiled evidence of human slave auctions in their country, which we reported on this show, and we had the reporters from CNN here talking about them. They cited the president's dismissal of CNN on Twitter as their pretext. The situation in Libya is grave, and these tweets appear to be giving the government there an excuse to deny what's real, which is slavery in their country.
Yeah, I mean, they have no regard for the actual lives that are being affected, because essentially when these come out in the campaign, it was upsetting or funny or annoying, but these, as much as they don't want to hold import to what they say comes out of Trump's tweets, like, these are words from the president, and they show no sign of understanding of the responsibility they have right now.
And do you see any sign of Dan Scavino's strategy and the president's embrace of him changing?
I mean, if anything, it seems to be getting more unhinged, I would say, recently. Referencing the deep state is new for him, which he's done a couple times over the past couple days. And I mean, it's definitely not going to slow down. If anything, I'd say we seem to be entering a more manic phase of this.
Ashley Feinberg, senior reporter, HuffPost. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And let's go to Honduras now, where voters are still waiting on the results of the country's presidential election that took place on Sunday. Incumbent President Juan Orlando Hernandez was expected to win the election, but a strong showing by opposition candidate Salvador Nasrallah has thrown the country into chaos. Nasrallah had an early lead. That lead is now narrowed, and now there are charges of fraud. Elizabeth Malkin is correspondent for The New York Times. She was recently in Honduras to observe the elections. She's in Mexico City now. Elizabeth, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
This vote in Honduras has been extremely contentious, Elizabeth. What are Juan Orlando Hernandez and Salvador Nasrallah saying now?
Salvador Nasrallah is telling people to defend the vote. The behavior of the Electoral Commission, this is a four-man body charged with counting the vote, has been very erratic since the election on Sunday. And Salvador Nasrallah, who is from the opposition party, was leading the vote. Very early Monday morning, the Electoral Commission announced that he was 5% ahead and then stopped counting. And there was nothing until Tuesday afternoon. And since Tuesday afternoon, that gap has been closed.
What has been Mr. Nasrallah's main pitch to voters?
His pitch has been that Juan Orlando Hernandez is on the ballot illegitimately. And that's a very strong pitch. Here's what happened. In 2009, there was a coup which ousted the president at the time, Manuel Zelaya, on the grounds that he was angling to violate the Constitution's ban on re-election, which is ironclad. However, Juan Orlando, when he was head of Congress, he replaced four members of the Supreme Court. And 2 years later, when he was president, they lifted that ban on the bizarre grounds that the ban was unconstitutional, even though it was in the Constitution. So there has been a question ever since as to whether Juan Orlando Hernandez could run for re-election.
Elizabeth, Honduras is a country crippled by violence and corruption. Have voters there been demanding that politicians put a stop to it? Are any elected officials responding to that?
Oh, yes, of course. It's a very important demand. Along with jobs, this is a country where two-thirds of the population live in poverty, and jobs really do accompany an improvement in security. There has been, under the presidency of Juan Orlando Hernandez, a small reduction in the number of murders. At one point, Honduras was the most murderous country at peace in the world. But those statistics have come down a little bit. Some of that is better policing. Some of that may be some actions that Juan Orlando Hernandez has taken selectively against certain drug cartels. There are a number of reasons. But yes, that's a key demand for everybody.
Well, the United States has a long history of intervening in Honduras. Right now, American authorities are concerned about migrants from Honduras and also MS-13 gangs, of course. I've heard Jeff Sessions talk about that. Where is the United States on this election? Where do the Americans come down?
Well, the Americans have been quite supportive of Juan Orlando Hernandez. Basically, he has extradited drug traffickers to the U.S., which never happened before. So this is something the U.S. has been very pleased with, beginning with the Obama administration and continuing now with the Trump administration. The U.S. has been quite mute on the issue of re-election and, you know, has sort of treated this as an internal issue. But now, as Honduras looks likely to spiral into days of protests and unrest, the U.S. is probably going to have to be a little bit more active.
Elizabeth Malkin with the New York Times, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The intercontinental ballistic missile launched by North Korea this week achieved new range that could allow the delivery of a nuclear weapon to the United States mainland. It's just the latest in a series of increasingly sophisticated North Korean missile tests. President Trump has renewed his rhetoric against Kim Jong-un and has called on China to increase sanctions. North Korea claims, meanwhile, that the test means that their rocketry development is now complete. Ambassador Chris Hill is a four-time ambassador and was the chief negotiator with North Korea during the six-party talks aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear program. He's currently dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver.
They've certainly made a tremendous amount of progress on their missile technology in the last couple of years. I'm not sure the basis for saying this is it or this is all they need to do. But one thing we know they need to do is to demonstrate that they can deliver a nuclear weapon, and they claim to be very much in the last stages of doing that. So whether they're in the last stages or already have done it or will soon do it, I think it adds up to a very serious problem that we need to address with great urgency.
Now, I guess everybody knew as we watched sort of the progressive march of missile technology over the last year or so that eventually one would be fired that could reach the middle of the United States. So maybe that's not a surprise. What does it mean to negotiators or to people who would like to set up the framework for a negotiation eventually with North Korea?
I think it's a big problem because I think once they have the missile technology and have the capacity to deliver nuclear weapons, the negotiations are no longer on the basis of what we've had them on in the past, which was the idea of complete denuclearization. That was the basis on which they participated in the six-party talks when I was involved with it some 8 to 10 years ago. So right now, I think the problem would be they might be prepared to talk, but they would talk more on the basis of some kind of sort of U.S.-Soviet SALT talks, that is a willingness to limit capabilities, but certainly not to eliminate them. So I think it's a very serious problem, and I think the Trump administration is going to have to step it up.
And what about China? The president during his trip made some statements suggesting that China was cooperating, at some point suggesting China is not doing enough to lean on its client, North Korea. What's the state of China's willingness to slow down or stop what Kim Jong-un is doing?
I think it's fair to say that China is rather split on the issue. There are those in China who would throw North Korea under the bus in a New York minute. I mean, they have no interest in a legacy relationship with North Korea. But there are many others in China, especially in their national security state, who worry about the presence of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula and ultimately feel that's a greater threat to China's well-being than the presence of nuclear weapons in North Korea. So I think China is split, and I think it behooves us to work very hard with China and not just go there episodically and flatter them and talk sort of generalities, but rather have the kinds of in-depth, weekly, even monthly discussions of the kind that Henry Kissinger had in the lead up to the Shanghai Accords in 1972.
So just to be clear before I let you go, Ambassador Chris Hill, you see in this latest development another step in some longer-term brinksmanship between North Korea, China, and the United States. And I ask it because given all the bluster between these leaders and all of the saber-rattling and bluster that comes from our own president, you don't see a situation where war is more likely than it was a year ago.
Correct. I don't see this as a short-term problem involving a second Korean War. I don't think the North Koreans plan to somehow put these missiles into operation against us. I see it more as a long-term strategy on their part quite a diabolical strategy, I might add, to essentially decouple the U.S. from South Korea and perhaps from its responsibilities more generally in Northeast Asia. So this is extremely dangerous to our interests. It requires good foreign policy. It requires a diplomatic strategy, which is a little hard to do when you don't have diplomats. But it requires overall a kind of level of focus that this administration has difficulties mustering.
Ambassador Chris Hill, former U.S. representative in the six-party talks and dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Ambassador, always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
It's great to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. The travel industry in America has been sounding an alarm lately. They call it the Trump slump. Now, to them, that's a decline in international tourism to the United States in response to rhetoric and policies from the president. That type of rhetoric might make foreign visitors feel unwelcome in the country. You might want to think about presidential tweets about Muslims we just talked about, a travel ban, or the idea of a border wall. Well, new data from the United States Department of Commerce on Wednesday says the number of foreign tourists to the U.S. dropped around 4% in the first 6 months of the year. And experts say that matters.
International tourism alone supports 1.2 million jobs and is responsible for $32 billion in wages.
That's Laura Mandela. She's CEO of Mandela Research. She analyzes data about the tourism industry.
And these are the kind of jobs that are ready to go. I mean, these are shovel ready, so to speak. You know, the hotels are built, the restaurants are open, the attractions are running. We have workers who want to work, who need to work.
So what's really behind the slump, and how is it hitting workers and business owners? Jake Halpert is on the front lines of the international tourist trade. He's founder of Evergreen Escapes. They're an adventure travel company out of Seattle. The business had been growing for 11 years, but this year, business dropped off by a whopping 25%. I asked Jake what happened.
Number one, I think that there is a sense of fear around visiting the United States right now. A lot to do with issues around gun violence. Homelessness remains an issue that's scaring off some of our travelers. And there's also a strong dollar. So that's keeping some of the visitors away. But ultimately, I think that a lot of our market and our travelers are consciously or subconsciously choosing not to travel to the United States. And I think that's due to the current political climate.
Talk a little bit more about the current political climate. Do you mean to say that people are staying away because of President Trump?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think the anti-foreigner rhetoric is affecting our reputation around the globe. People are either disinterested in coming and supporting the destination, or they're just postponing and waiting to come at a different time. And so there's ongoing conversations between my sales staff, my team, and our direct clients, but also in our B2B relationships with our resellers overseas. They're having the same conversations with their client. There's just this general apathy and disinterest in visiting the United States right now. It just doesn't feel comfortable for a lot of these individuals.
Talk a little bit more about the typical evergreen customer, let's say in, I don't know, Taiwan or Beijing, and who they are and what they might be saying about visiting Evergreen now.
You know, these are high integrity individuals, and they are highly educated. They are interested in making intentional decisions. And when they look at the U.S. travel experiences right now, when they seek out us, they're looking for local experiences. We want to introduce them to the culture and the nature and national parks, get them embedded into our local communities. But right now, when they take a look at that, they're seeing that their integrity is not aligned with what the U.S. stands for at the moment.
Jake, I was surprised to hear you say that you thought homelessness was at the top of people's list of concerns when deciding not to come to the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're based in Seattle. We have base camps in Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco. And many of my friends in the industry that come out and do product development and, you know, get out and explore the region, they'll often get to the destination and actually be pretty uncomfortable with the in-your-face homelessness in the streets. And that instills a sense of fear, which is unfortunate. That obviously translates to the end traveler as well when they're here and walking through our urban centers and our cities. And they might be going to great restaurants, but they're walking by homeless individuals. that's making them feel a little bit uncomfortable about the destination overall.
So, Jake, a 25% downturn in your foreign traffic is an awful lot. I wonder if that's sustainable. What's the future of your business?
After, you know, 25, 30, 35% growth out of the last 3 years, we're looking at, you know, being stagnant this year. And when we're on that trajectory, it's put an incredible crunch on cash flow. You know, I've been put in a position where I have to make some very difficult decisions. And I've decided that I need to sell my business and try to find a buyer that can scale and help grow this and overcome some of these obstacles. But the volatility is and the current climate is almost rendered me helpless, and my hands are tied behind my back. I've got a family to look after. I've got an amazing team, and I just don't have the means to be able to combat this type of negative impact.
Jake, talk about this government project, Brand USA. It's an organization that promotes the United States overseas as a tourist destination. Now, President Trump has suggested cutting it entirely as part of his budget. I guess we'll see if Congress goes along with that or not. But how important has Brand USA been to your business?
It's absolutely pivotal. I mean, I think that we really started seeing growth when Brand USA was established, and they've had remarkable success with what they've done. I was reading recently that they provide a 27-to-1 return on investment. So I would imagine Congress isn't going to let anything like that pass. But it is disappointing when that stuff gets into the news, when Trump's talking about building walls and putting money into keeping foreigners out, when the incoming tourist represents this wonderful opportunity to grow our economy. And it's proven to do so.
I mean, Jake, have you talked to your member of Congress or your local chamber of commerce? Because a call from a guy like you who's got a high-end business, who's bringing in people from overseas and bringing money into the community and employing people, who says, I'm going to sell because customers aren't coming in. I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets people's attention. Have you talked to them? What are they saying to you?
Yeah, absolutely. For many years now, and I actually sit in a state that that doesn't currently have a state marketing group or budget. And so that's a very hot topic in Washington state. And here we are with some of the most amazing national parks, great wine regions, and this wonderful urban center that is the Emerald City of Seattle. And so this has been an ongoing battle here. But there's just in the U.S., there's a general lack of understanding and a little bit of ignorance on the benefits of tourism. And so a lot of us in the United States just figure that visitors are going to come no matter what, which is absolutely not true. This last year, we've dropped from being the number 4 most visited destination to the number 6 or 7. We've been taken over by Japan and Great Britain. And so I think that Brand USA has done wonderful things for us. But it also takes a more holistic approach. It takes all of us here in the destinations to be open and ready and really rolling out the welcome mat to these visitors.
Well, it sounds like the welcome mat at Evergreen, at least with you in charge, Jake, might soon be a thing of the past if you find a buyer. What do you have your eye on? What's next for you?
Yeah, well, I'm looking at travel as an opportunity to break down walls. It's always been just a wonderful opportunity to connect individuals locally and around the planet. And, you know, I think part of the reason that we're in this position, this Trump slump on the tourism side, is because many of American travelers aren't getting out, don't have passports, don't have the opportunity to get overseas and build the traits of empathy and stewardship. So I'm focused on changing and reclaiming travel, focusing on personal transformation and personal growth through travel. And I think that will lead to global citizenship and a better planet.
Jake Halpert, founder of Evergreen Escapes. Jake, good luck.
All right. Thank you very much, Todd.
Hi, this is Rima Haider from Boston. Many of my friends in London won't visit me in the U.S. because they don't like being questioned and fingerprinted by U.S. immigration. When I go to the U.K., I just breeze right through immigration. And so I can see that my friends make a fair point. I just visit them in London instead.
Do you have friends or family who've decided not to visit the United States from abroad? We got this from Fiona on Facebook. My little cousin is going to visit Toronto instead of California. His parents are worried that something bad could happen, like him being locked in a little room at an American airport as a minor while nobody gives information, since that happened during the chaos of the Muslim ban. We want to hear from you. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a comment on our Facebook page about travel to the United States or anything else you hear on the show. You're a huge part of the show, and we always want to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.